Thanks for joining me today on CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, and this week is certainly a remarkable one for our nation with the inauguration of Joe Biden as our 46th President of the United States, January 20th. The inauguration took place just 2 days before another remarkable date, the 48th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. And that has been marked each January 22nd by the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. And I was checking out the March for Life website, and they note that this year the march has been modified because of COVID and because of security issues in our nation's capital and heightened pressures upon law enforcement after that violent January 6th storming of the Capitol and some valid concerns about further acts of violence and disruption, it seems. The march for this year is taking place virtually with a small group of pro-life leaders from across the country participating in the actual march in Washington, D.C. on the 22nd. Well, because of the Roe v. Wade anniversary, together with the annual March for Life this week, I decided to invite to the program Dr. Donna Harrison, who became a good friend and physician colleague of mine for 3 years in a large Christian practice in Michigan that I was a part of in the early 90s. God has directed Donna's steps and placed her in a position of leading the largest association of pro-life OBGYNs in the world today, and it's called APLOG, or the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. So I invite you right now to listen in to my conversation with Dr. Harrison as I was joined by another obstetrician, our very own CMDA Senior Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy, Dr. Jeff Barrows, who, by the way, will be giving our Washington, D.C. report later in the program. It's an immense privilege for me to welcome today to CMDA Matters Dr. Donna Harrison, who's a physician, a board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, and an old friend of mine dating back to 1993 when we, for 2 or 3 years, practiced together in Southwest Michigan. And I think I might have even first assisted on a hysterectomy or two with Dr. Harrison back in those days at Berrien General Hospital. Donna and I went separate paths, but we have come back together both as executive directors of different Christian organizations, professional associations. Since 2013, Donna has been the executive director of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is the largest non-sectarian pro-life physician organization in the world, with over 4,000 members across the United States, as well as associate members on every continent. Under her leadership, she has seen APLOG double its membership, and they have launched a very popular conference, annual conference, called the Matthew Bulfin Educational Conference. And she's developed lots of up-to-date website and social media presence information, launched systematic outreaches to the medical, legal, and policy communities. She's an adjunct professor at Trinity International University in Deerfield, Illinois. She teaches post-grad seminars at the annual Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity Summer Workshops. She's an associate editor of the peer-reviewed medical journal called Issues in Law and Medicine. I've asked to join me today Dr. Jeff Barrows, who's also an OBGYN and our Senior Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy. So welcome, Dr. Harrison. Welcome, Dr. Barrows.
Thank you.
Good to be here with you, Mike.
Well, Dr. Harrison, it is the 48th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and you have been fighting against the evil of abortion for many, many years. Can you tell our listeners how you got involved in public policy and this fight in the public square against abortion?
God works in mysterious ways. It's not what I set out to do when I trained as an OB-GYN, but in residency, it would bother me terribly that the lecturers on abortion would lie. They would lie about who was in the womb. They would lie about how the procedures were done and what was taken out. And I don't like people that publicly lie, especially when they're in a teaching situation. So I got involved way back in residency, in medical school, actually, And I created an alternative handout for the class that was on abortion, which caused quite a stir. But it showed me, it demonstrated to me that telling the truth about abortion really does change hearts and minds, especially physician hearts and minds. And that conviction never left me. So when I went into private practice, as you know, Mike, because we were in the same group, my husband and I intended to go overseas to practice. But I had a obligation. It was not a written obligation, but a understanding for one of the scholarships that I had to pay for medical school, that I would spend 2 years in public policy to pay off that four-year scholarship. So medical school, residency, beginning private practice, there just isn't much time for a two-year break. So when I had been in practice for a while and our son died, which you know, it was time for me to reevaluate what I was really being called to do. And I decided at that point to take and fulfill that two-year public policy commitment. And I think I'm on my close to my 20th year of that two-year public policy commitment.
Tell us what you think about what you see in the landscape now at the 48th anniversary of Roe v. Wade.
Well, I think the challenges will increase, there's no doubt. Probably one of our biggest challenges we've been facing off with since the 1960s, which is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and their rabid pro-abortion policies. So we know that most OBGYNs, like 75 to 85%, depending on which study you look at, of OBGYNs in the United States do not do abortions as part of their private practice. And it's certainly not because we don't know how to. Okay, we all know how to empty a uterus at any gestational age and quickly. But the point of most OBGYNs emptying the uterus is to produce a live baby. That's what we work for. The baby is our second patient. And most OBGYNs recognize that. That's why we went into OBGYN. And yet, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology uses their heft to call for some just incredibly unprofessional actions, like the use of the abortion pill without any testing for Rh positivity, without any knowledge of what gestational age a woman is at, without an ultrasound, without ruling out ectopic pregnancy. I mean, this is it is hard to believe that ACOG can so pervert the purpose of OB-GYN to just use it for a pro-abortion agenda. And I think it's time for ACOG members to start questioning ACOG and to say, how do you come up with that? Mm-hmm. What's your data behind no-touch abortion? Why are you pushing abortion on those of us who want to protect the preborn child as well as our female patient who's pregnant? So I think that's probably our biggest challenge moving forward. You know, the political landscape, we will speak out whenever we have an opportunity to talk about the truth of who's in the womb, because there is someone in there and we know it. In fact, most of the world knows it now with ultrasound. There's no question that this is a blob of tissue. This is a baby. So we will speak about that. We'll speak about the reality of the purpose of an abortion, which is to produce a dead baby. It's not to end a pregnancy. It's actually to make sure that the offspring of that pregnancy is dead when it's delivered. These are the realities that policy people need to know, that the American people need to know. And we equip our members to be able to say that and to defend both the pregnant woman and her unborn child based on the medical literature.
Well, Donna, I know that there have been a lot of numbers thrown out there in the past, though you don't hear so much anymore. My son is a pastor, and I was talking to him about this, and I mentioned the number of abortions that were being done, at least the last I had checked, and he was quite surprised. So I don't know how many of our listeners really know what the estimate is in terms of how many babies are regularly aborted here in the U.S., and I don't know if you happen to have any numbers worldwide, but can you kind of give us a little overview of some of those estimates?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say that any of these numbers are an underestimate, and the reason is because where we get our numbers from is from the Center for Disease Control or the Guttmacher Institute. Both of those sources of data come from voluntary reports by abortionists. There is no mandatory abortion reporting. Mm-hmm. So despite the ability in 2020 to track to the number of positive COVID tests in this country, in 2020, We don't even have some states reporting the number of abortions, like California. We've got two or three states that don't give any reports at all. And we know that there are a huge number done there. So anything that I say is an underestimate. But the estimates around 60 million abortions have been done in the United States since Roe versus Wade. And I want to put that in a little bit of perspective, okay? If we take the total number of Americans who have died in all the wars in America ever fought and combine them all together, we get about 1,264,289. Compare that to 60 million children who have died at the hands of abortionists. And these are elective abortions. These are abortions done not to save the life of the woman. These are abortions done for social reasons because someone wanted this baby dead. And I think that's something that we should ponder. 60 million versus 1.2 million in all the wars that have ever been fought in the United States.
You know, Donna, as I was just doing some reading this week about Roe v. Wade, learning a number of things that I've never known. As a general surgeon, my eyes were opened in terms of the decision and the logic behind it, and just shaking my head, actually, over a number of liberal legal opinions about the lack of constitutional basis for Roe v. Wade. It seems to me that we hear about Roe v. Wade, it's been the law since 1973. It seems so entrenched. And I guess in general polls that I read, over 50% of Americans say, no, it shouldn't be overturned. 23 or 25% say it should be overturned. But when you look at the actual judgment that was made, the things that Justice Blackmun wrote in that majority 7-2 opinion, and then read what even one of his own law clerks said about 25 or 30 years later about how little constitutional basis there was for Roe v. Wade. I just wonder if that story, if we keep telling the story of the lack of constitutional basis, what do you think are the possibilities that with a more conservative, potentially pro-life Supreme Court, that some of examination will happen again by the Supreme Court?
Well, boy, I sure hope there's a reexamination. And I sure hope that there's a reexamination by people who think that the Constitution is really the basis of the government in the United States, because that's not the way Roe versus Wade was decided. So Roe versus Wade is actually a very interesting decision. And as you know, it overturned the laws in about 45 states at the time it was decided. It was decided on the basis of this penumbra, the shadow of the right to privacy, but it's not a right to privacy. If you look at the 14th Amendment, it's a right to privately own property. That becomes really important in other decisions that have spun off from Roe versus Wade. For example, APLUG has filed amicus briefs in several embryo dispute cases in IVF, where one parent wants the embryos killed and the other parent wants the embryos implanted. And when you look at those decisions, the question comes up, how do you decide the fate of human embryos? And there are two different competing questions. Currently, human embryos are decided under the right to privately own property, human beings as property. And APLUG argued, no, these embryos should be decided with the body of jurisprudence that has to do with family law, that is, what's in the best interest of the embryo. But because of the precedent in Roe versus Wade, because of this ability to kill human beings based on the right to privately own property, the embryo disputes have been decided according to property law, thanks to the 14th Amendment and Roe versus Wade. But it's one thing that's kind of interesting people don't realize. It's not Roe versus Wade that legalized abortion for any reason throughout 9 months of pregnancy. It's actually the companion decision, Doe versus Bolton. And that's part of the reason that APLUG exists, actually, because in the early 1960s, ACOG, American College of OB-GYN, had a majority in its leadership who were pro-life, but that changed in the mid-70s to a bare majority pro-abortion. But that pro-abortion majority sidestepped the membership completely and began to actively lobby for abortion legalization. And they used the full weight of ACOG membership to do it. And in fact, the ACOG pro-abortion leadership was instrumental in helping to craft the wording of Doe versus Bolton. What did they do? They used a very utilitarian hedonistic definition of health, which included all physical, social, psychological, familiar, or any other factor, in order to do what the Supreme Court said, which was allow the abortionists the ability to call anything a health exception. So it's actually ACOG who helped to author this health exception, and it's the combination of Roe and Doe together, because Doe defines what health means, that made abortion legal throughout 9 months of pregnancy. So, you know, you've heard people rightly decry the laws that the state of New York and other states have passed, which allow for the killing of human beings up to the moment of birth and maybe even after. But that's nothing different than what was already has been allowed for 48 years under Roe. But anyway, when that happened, when ACOG helped to define the health exception for Doe and make abortion legal, the remaining pro-life leadership in ACOG decided in 1973 to form US, the American Association of Pro-Life OB-GYNs. And we were the largest special interest group within ACOG for over 40 years. And when I took over in 2013, ACOG decided to discontinue the term special interest group altogether to try to get rid of us. I'd love to think it was because of me, but I'm not that conceited. But what they did is it freed APLOG to triple our size. We have over 5,000 members now, mostly OB-GYNs, but we have some other members who are involved with reproductive health. And we have to exist to be a professional second opinion to ACOG's pro-abortion activism. So I hope that there will be a re-look at the foundations of Roe v. Wade, but there also needs to be a reevaluation of Doe versus Bolton and a definition of health that has to do with health of the mother and health of the unborn child. We have to recognize that children that can live outside the womb after 22 weeks, there's absolutely no reason they should be targeted for intentional destruction.
Donna, it's so sobering to listen to you talk about this and to be reminded of the fact that babies can be aborted in some states all the way up till 9 months. And it can be very depressing. And I'm glad to be able to say that I've been an APLOG member for at least 20 years, if not more. I don't remember exactly. It's that far back that I don't remember exactly when I joined. But I'm going to maybe shift the conversation a little bit, because while it's depressing, I think a lot of times we as healthcare professionals feel like, well, there's nothing we can do. You know, it's in the legal court, it's at the Supreme Court, it's up to the state legislatures. But I want to kind of address the issue of practicing healthcare professionals in communities. I know that one of the frequent criticisms that we in the pro-life movement get is that we're only concerned about births and not really the women after or during the time that they're dealing with this unintended pregnancy. So can you talk a little bit about some of the organizations that you're aware of that come alongside these women with these unintended pregnancies and how healthcare professionals can volunteer with those groups?
Yeah, that's great, Jeff. I'm so glad you brought up that topic, because APLOG has organizational members from CareNet, Heartbeat, and NIFLA. And there are many ways that a practicing physician can actually help, because those organizations are the ones on the front lines for caring for patients. They've received the calls from the woman who took her Mifeprex pill and now she regrets it and she wishes there were some way to save her baby. And so a physician can volunteer to be part of the Abortion Pill Rescue Network. And that is physicians who are willing to give women progesterone after they take the first pill, Mifeprex, to try to increase their chances that the baby will survive. There are so many pregnancy care centers who are looking for medical directors, for docs who are willing to read ultrasounds. It doesn't take a tremendous amount of time. You know, it takes being willing to be on the front lines and willing to support the massive effort that is put out mostly by volunteers, by people who care, who are trying to take care and supply these women, not only talk them out of abortion, but to actually really meet their physical needs, to provide them with the social work connections they need, to provide them with jobs, to provide them with food and a place to live. I mean, pregnancy care centers do so much. And anyone who says that pro-life people don't care about the woman are just ignorant. They just really don't understand what all pregnancy care centers do. So I'd really encourage anybody who's listening to seriously consider helping out with your local pregnancy care center, especially consider being part of the Abortion Pill Reversal Network, and especially consider being willing to read ultrasounds if you have that skill set, which are life-changing for women who see their baby.
Donna, in contrast to what you've just described for crisis pregnancy centers, would you be willing to talk a little bit about how the abortion industry has actually exploited poor and minority populations?
Yeah, the abortion movement has been eugenic since its roots, since its founding. I mean, Margaret Sanger was the founder of Planned Parenthood, which actually, I believe, started out as the American Eugenics Society, and they changed their name after World War II. The purpose was to create a race of thoroughbreds. That was the purpose of Planned Parenthood. And the abortion industry has never lost sight of that purpose. And in fact, there are several different estimates looking at location of Planned Parenthood clinics. And the estimates around 70% of them, maybe even a little higher, 74%, are located within walking distance of a Black or Hispanic neighborhood. And that is not by accident. Abortion in this country stands on four legs. Okay, like if you think of a chair, abortion stands on four legs. The first leg is, oh, well, it's just a blob of tissue. Nobody really believes that anymore because we all see ultrasounds. The second leg is, well, abortion's really good for women. And that's the leg that APLOG chews on. We look at the medical literature and we say, breast cancer, preterm birth, you know, depression, suicide, drug abuse, this is not good for women. The third leg, though, is we don't want those kind of people reproducing. And that's the leg that gets funded. Those who want to eliminate Black and Hispanic populations in the United States or control them fund Planned Parenthood and other abortion activities as a population control measure. And that's really where the funding comes from. And then, of course, the fourth leg is the women's rights leg, which was actually a hijacking of women's rights, just to let you know. It's not what the original feminists wanted at all. But the fourth leg is, if he can walk away, I can walk away. If you want to look at something that will make you weep, go to the Guttmacher website or Google reasons women abort. He's gone. My parents said I had to. I have two kids and I know there's no one around to help me. I didn't have any choice. Or this was a quote from one of the papers on there. They interviewed a woman who said, I could choose anything I wanted to as long as I aborted. So the whole women's rights thing has become a mechanism of coercion. And Jeff, you're well familiar with that kind of reproductive coercion with your work with the sex trafficked women. But, you know, those are the legs that they stand on. And the eugenic leg is a very strong leg and well-funded.
Well, I was just going to bring that up, Donna, because you were talking a little bit, touched on the vulnerable. And of course, there's very few that are more vulnerable than our young kids or women that get entrapped into sex trafficking. And there is a very clear connection with abortion. So if you just talk a little bit about that in some general terms for our listeners, I'm sure most of them are unaware of this connection.
It's a very sad connection, but there's been a number of studies looking at women who have been sex trafficked and how did they interact with the medical community. Sadly, most of us were not taught to recognize the signs of sex trafficking. But one statistic that struck me in reading these papers is that about a third to maybe even a fourth of women who were sex trafficked, their primary interaction with healthcare workers was Planned Parenthood. And Planned Parenthood aids and abets this by not reporting. I'll give you an example. There was one case of a 13-year-old girl, 13 or 14-year-old girl who had come in with her third or fourth pregnancy. I believe it was in Atlanta. And when asked why Planned Parenthood never reported this girl to Protective Services, they said, well, we didn't have any reason to think she was being mistreated. Now, come on. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to say if you're there at 14 with your third pregnancy, this is sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. Whether this is sexual abuse. Okay, so this kind of aiding and abetting is just horrific. And I'll give you another example. Most people don't realize that the abortion pill, Mifeprex, right now, can be obtained online. There's about 86 different websites. One of those websites, I'm sure it's more than one, but at least one of those websites offered a bulk discount if you buy Mifepristone in bulk. Now, who in the world is going to buy Mifepristone in bulk except a pimp or an abuser? So it's this kind of incestuous relationship between the abortion industry and sex trafficking that needs to be broken, and they need to all be broken at the same time. Abortion is just a marker of abuse of women.
Dr. Harrison, we will look forward to working with you. We'll pray for APLOG and for all of your efforts. Thank you for taking time out today at the beginning of 2021 to join us.
And Donna, thank you so much. All that you're doing with APLOG and your tremendous efforts. Appreciate that, and great admiration of all your work.
Thank you very much.
Well, as Dr. Harrison mentioned, there have been a different set of standards for care and reporting that have been applied to abortion as a surgical procedure or medical treatment, and I put that last word in quotes. A past CMDA Matters guest, Dr. Brent Bowles, in his book, Supremely Wrong, provides an honest perspective from one of those 80 to 85% of board-certified OBGYNs in America that Donna mentioned who do not participate in abortion. Dr. Bowles, in his book, points out that leading embryology textbooks clearly demonstrate when life begins. Applying principles of medical ethics to challenge popular pro-choice narrative, Supremely Wrong advances the national dialogue on life issues with surprising stories and accessible logic. I think it could serve as a great equipping resource to help you promote a constructive dialogue with your pro-choice friends or medical colleagues. Another great book I want to mention to you to help you sort out the complexities of the abortion issue is Fearfully and Wonderfully Made: Ethics and the Beginning of Human Life by Megan Best. You can get a copy of one or both of these books at cmda.org/store or just by calling 888-230-2637 today. I would like today to personally invite you to join me in improving your communication skills by registering for the next 501 Foundations for Christian Coaching course that will be held Monday evenings online, February 1st through March 8th. And this online training will equip you to help colleagues out of burnout, help patients own and achieve their own health goals, and increase your impact as you draw out and maximize the potential in others. Registration is now open to all healthcare professionals, students, spouses, and others who work with healthcare professionals. Also, check out this month's Healthy Doctor podcast, one of our other podcast offerings, as Center for Wellbeing Director Dr. Steve Sartori discusses the power of gratitude to prevent burnout with Dr. Mark Greenewald. You know, God has blessed CMDA with a great ministry partner over the last couple of years, Dallas Theological Seminary and the Hendricks Center there, as together we have launched the CMDA and DTS Dialogues, Healthcare and Theology, Learning Together. Join us for our next co-hosted webinar, which is Wednesday, February 10th at 12:30 Eastern Time, on the topic, Engaging with the Beginning of Human Life, a topic that goes right with our interview with Dr. Harrison today. For more information and to register, just visit cmda.org/DTS webinar. I believe that all of us could use some encouragement this year and a reminder that when we walk with Jesus, He also walks with us through the best and our most difficult circumstances. Walking through COVID-19 with Jesus is a half-day virtual conference event that our Women Physicians in Christ ministry will be hosting on February 20th. Make sure you register online. You know, you can find out more information and register for any of these events and others at cmda.org/events, or if you're listening on your tablet or laptop, they will be linked in the show notes. Well, Dr. Jeff Barrows has our Washington update today.
For this week's Washington Update, one of the ways we serve as your voice in public policy is to inform the courts through lawsuits and legal briefs. As the White House and Congress will be strongly influenced by a pro-abortion, anti-religious freedom agenda, these court cases will play an extremely important role in protecting vital freedoms and upholding life-affirming values. For example, we just recently agreed to file a friend of the court or amicus brief in an appeal in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. This case arises from a challenge to Tennessee's 48-hour abortion waiting period law. In another case, the Christian Legal Society will represent us in defending campus religious freedom. In that case, InterVarsity versus Wayne State, we will argue that Wayne State University's non-discrimination policy discriminates against religion in violation of the free exercise and free speech clauses by barring only religious student groups from setting criteria for leadership based on group ideology. And of course, we are continuing to fight for your conscience freedom and medical judgment in two court cases in which we are represented by Beckett Law Firm. The first case is to defend a good federal conscience freedom rule for healthcare professionals. The second case is to stop a federal transgender mandate that would overrule both your medical judgment and conscience freedom. You will find a listing and brief description of all 76 of our court cases over the past quarter century at freedomtocare.org. That's freedom, the number two, care.org. And you can find it under the Law and Court Cases tab. Please pray for these important life-affirming and conscience freedom court cases.
Well, I'd like to close today and share with you what one of our senior CMDA ministry leaders shared with all of us in chapel last week. "Hey, CMDA," she said, "in matters of taste, go with the flow. But in matters of principle, stand like a rock." Well, what she shared on that day immediately made me think of the prophet Isaiah's testimony in chapter 50, verse 7, where he says, "Because the sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like a stone, determined to do his will, and I know that I will not be put to shame." One of the ways that CMDA seeks to serve our members and honor God is by standing up for Christian principles in healthcare and public policy these days. We know from a survey of over 1,600 of our members, many of you probably who filled out last October a survey, that standing up against evil such as abortion matters to you greatly. And that's why it matters to CMDA and CMDA Matters. Next week, we will be hearing from Reverend James Brooks and Dr. Daisy Dowell, two servant leaders of the Lawndale Clinic on the Near West Side of Chicago. I think their testimony about what God is doing in the heart of Chicago in the midst of a pandemic just might inspire you. So please join me next week for another edition of CMDA Matters. God bless you, and we'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.